understands what the objection here is. The objection, of course, was one of infection or the infection may be an anachronism, but the notion that a disease might be transmitted from the moil to the child, let's not use the word infection because this is before the germ theory of disease, but in any event, that was the actual objection. But he believes that this perhaps the objection derives from the side. All right. Don't be astonished that what the doctors are today saying is against the Gemara. Because in many things nature has changed, and he lists a whole supply of them. Okay? And again, you have to now decide in your own mind that when he uses the phrase nishtaneh hateva, he means really that nature has changed, or he's using it as a euphemism to mean that our knowledge is superior to Talmudic knowledge. He lists a whole lot of examples, such as the length of whether a child can be born in the eighth month will survive, as if a child is not as one, the question of whether a cow can give milk prior or after a certain period of time after giving birth. There's a whole slew of examples, there are examples which Tosfot, and he lists them all, which mention. Okay. At first blush, one would say, that we should pay attention to what they say in all such matters. Even in capital cases, you pay attention to medical opinion, as for example, as to whether the person that was killed was viable, or did the murderer kill a dead man, and various other issues. There are many, many places in which we listen to medical opinion. So therefore, why shouldn't we listen to medical opinion on this matter? The afilu lahaker, and even to be lenient, to allow something to be done on Shabbat, for example, in all these cases, we abide by medical opinion. Mikol shekerin kishenachush rak mishum sakana. And certainly in a situation where all we're worried about is a matter of danger to the child. They know more about dangers to health than we do. Okay? Now, if the Tiferet Yisrael would have stopped there, there would be no problem as to what he's actually saying. He would be simply giving more or less, maybe a little bit more drastically, a repeat performance of what the Chatam Sofer said, or what Rav Shrir Agon said, namely, medical opinion is to be valued on medical matters more than a Talmudic statement.
But he uses the phrase Nishtaneh
Hateva. Yeah, he uses the phrase Nishtaneh Hateva, and we don't know what he means by that. He could mean that in fact nature has changed, like Professor Steinberg, or he could simply use that as a euphemism. Because it was a standard euphemism, as you said, it was a cover. We don't want to say that the rabbis were wrong. Why do we have to say that? Things have changed. But Nishtaneh Hateva could be a cover for simply saying that our knowledge has improved.
I have no flavor that when the people say that, they don't really believe it. I don't believe that they view it as a cover. I think that they really believe it.
Some do and some don't. It depends who's using it.
Who does?
I don't think that when Rav Moshe uses the phrase Nishtaneh Hateva, and allows a biopsy, even though the Talmud says that a biopsy would render the man sterile, that is a puncture of the testes would render a man sterile, and he uses the phrase Nishtaneh Hateva several times, I do not believe for one moment that he thought that had this same precise medical operation been performed in Talmudic times, the man would have been sterile, but it's been...
But it's possible that in the 1800s they did not know how nature changed.
I'm open-minded on this issue. I say there are some people, like Rav Moshe Feinstein, who I don't believe for a minute thought that there was no advance in medical knowledge. He was much too sophisticated for that. And on the other hand, the general level of sophistication of the Tiferes Yisrael was quite high, so he could have meant this as a cover, or he could have meant that nature has changed. Had the discussion stopped here, I would have been open to either interpretation. But now, yes,
just the place that prepares the trial, was Danzig then a place with German?
Yeah, the German
German
city.
Influence, or was it Eastern European?
Well, it was in the middle. It was a port town in Upper Schlesia. It was, you know, it was a German city.
But was he like in the Lithuanian school?
No, he was the rabbi of the town, and he dealt with many, many modern problems, and frequently he was quite lenient in his rulings. He was no, this was, okay? In Graz, right.
Yeah, it was a Prussian.
Yeah, in Prussia. Okay. All right. So, if the matter had stopped there, that would be it. The Nakel Gam But Gam Bachelol Shabbat Lintzos, that's a little difficult to understand what he's driving at. He should say that we should not be mekel on Shabbat Lintzos, because if it is no longer a life-saving device, it should be prohibited to do it on Shabbat. So the language is a little confusing. V'afal pichei nira li, nevertheless, even though the medical doctors should know more than we do, v'afal pichei nira li levi lazuz midivrei Rabbeinu Zal. We should not deviate from what our rabbis have taught us. Golo dami l'rochitza l'kamon simen lamed beis she'ein machalalin hashda mishenishtaneh hateva. This is not like the issue of rinsing, washing off the child, which we no longer perform today because nature has changed. The hatam shayni al yudei shenishtaneh hateva ein bo tzorech klal hashda. Because nature has changed, there is no longer any need to perform this. Aval hacha, milo modul harofim da yidei matzitza nitzal atinok mitzviyat hagid. Don't the rabbis agree that by performing this matzitza we will save the child from the swelling of the member?
Doctors.
Yeah, won't the doctors agree? Excuse me. Won't the doctors agree that by tzitza we'll finish that? Ella, שבארצות הצפונים אינו מסוכן כל כך צביעת הגיד כבארצות בבל. In the northern climes, this danger of the swelling of the member is not as great as it was in Babylonia. חכמים, in the hot climes. ואף על פי כן, אפשר שיסתכן על ידי הצביע. Nevertheless, there is this danger of the swelling. ואף שלפי דעת הרופאים יכול להצל הצביעה על ידי שיתנו על כל חצי שעה מטלית שנשרה בבני אקסטרקטוס, even though one can deal with the swelling by applying every half an hour a band-aid with some extract, או במים קרים, or apply cold water, על כל פנים כיוון וגם לפי דבריהם גם מציצה מהני, since according to their opinions, מציצה will also be beneficial. How he got that, I don't know. Ein lanu ela divrei Rabbi Chazal. All that we have is the opinion of Chazal. Daharei afilu bedivrei Torah, kishein nafkamina shiyasa kein o kein, hayu harishonim makpidim lasot divrei Rabboteihem. When even on matters of Torah, if one had an alternative of doing things one way or the other, one relied on their rabbis. Karavadu mahada asilka varuza hoi v'nafek nipuma d'rachuna. V'achol pichei nirali, nevertheless, it seems to me, shalolim tzotz kol kach b'chozek ma'od b'shabbat. Don't suck too strongly on Shabbat. The v'gemara lo ka'amar reik ha'umna b'lo ma'itz, mashma b'lo ma'itz klav. Gam yal-yozeh piv achoya matzitza l'achabura, me'im ha'chomet shalokeach b'fiv. He should wash the thing out with vinegar, from the vinegar he puts in his mouth, kidei la'hakamem ul'tzamtzei nikvei ha'porin she in order to contract the pores that he opened with his mitzitza. So what does he say? This was, on the one hand he says, well, Chazal couldn't have been 100% wrong. On the other hand he says, well, maybe they were wrong, and therefore on Shabbat you should be a little bit careful not to do this too much, because you might be being mechalel Shabbat. Where?
When?
In the first part of, in the 1840s probably, the last section. Okay. Now, he was willing, in some sense or other, to agree that medical opinion overruled what the rabbi said, but he couldn't quite, psychologically, he couldn't quite get to the belief that the rabbis were 100% wrong.
He's saying that the doctors agree that they are right.
Did he investigate? Did he ask any doctor to say that they were right? Had he asked any doctor at that point, I doubt that he would have gotten an opinion that they were right. They would have told him that a swelling, which we would today interpret as infection of the penis, was a dangerous possible side effect, but they wouldn't have told him that sucking the wound would have had any effect on that, and they certainly wouldn't have told him that the letting the blood flow through so that with the siphon or any other effect that you want to call it would prevent the accumulation of blood in the wound and cause the swelling. So the situation is, he understands that the doctors are right, but he can't quite bring himself to say that the rabbis were completely wrong. Now, so this was my interpretation, and Professor Katz, of course, as I said, made the point that the real difference in the back of his mind was an unstated one, namely that the washing of the child was not part of the ceremony, whereas the mitzitza was part of the ceremony, and once there were attack on Jewish ceremonies altogether, then this particular aspect of it was raised to the level of an ideological battle on attacks on ceremonies. My point is
so that it is part of the circumcision procedure by some view. The mitzitza is an integral part of it, whereas washing is not. Is that what we're saying?
No. What Professor Katz is saying is that in the mind of a layman who's observing this procedure from the outside, he doesn't see that the child is washed or it's not washed or whether he's washed on the third day. That's clearly not part of the ceremony. If you attend a brit, you see that there are three steps are performed, and the man in the street can't know in his own mind that the mitzitza is performed for medical reasons, whereas the first two things were performed for reasons of the mitzvah itself. Therefore, once there was a general attack on other forms of Jewish ceremony for aesthetic and other reasons, the rabbis, in particular Rabbi Ettlinger, if we have time we will read what he has to say on the subject, elevated this procedure, which was initially a purely medical one, to become part of the ceremony. But sociologically, an outside observer, this is Professor Katz's take on this, an outside observer would regard the mitzitza as part of the ceremony, whereas the washing of the infant was not part of the ceremony, and that's really the hidden agenda behind what the Tiferes Yisrael is trying to do here. He can't quite bring himself to say that a practice which has been observed for all of these thousands of years was in fact based on a misapprehension of the medical facts. My take on it is that there is indeed this additional ideological component on the inability to accept the fact that the rabbis could have been wrong on a straight issue of medical fact. And one proof of that is another attempt by the Tiferes Yisrael to deal with a perhaps more famous contradiction.
Doesn't he also say that he takes a conflicting testimony by two doctors that you go back to the basic beginning point?
No, that's not his main point here. His main point here is all doctors agree that this is dangerous, but doctors do agree that it does some good, and therefore, well, we'll do it a little bit. And certainly on Shabbat we have a problem. If you do it much and it's not any good, then you're being mechalel Shabbat, so do it a little less on Shabbat.
Now, was this the timing after the germ theory of disease?
No, the germ theory of disease is very late. That's
late.
That's in the 1890s or thereabouts. Okay. But now let's come to a more crucial biological issue, because again, this is interesting. This is also the Tathagatas, and I didn't reproduce it for you, so you have to believe me that I'm reading the Mishnah and the Tathagatas Yisrael correctly. Beitzat Hasheretz, this is the Mishnah, in famous Mishnah in Perek Tefik Chulin. Yeah. Beitzat Hasheretz Amurukemet Tahora, a fully formed egg of a crawling creature is Tahora. Nikva Kosheru, but once the egg has begun to open, it's Tamea. Achbar, Shechetzio Basar Vechetzio Adama, a mouse which is half flesh and half earth. Hanogea babasar tamei. If you touch the fleshy part, you become tamei. Ba'adama tahor. Rabbi Yehuda omer, af hanogea ba'adama shekeneged habasar tamei. Even if you touch the... So here you have a mouse which is being formed out of the earth, and the first of the fore part, the front part of the mouse has been formed. Mouse itself would make you tamei. If you touch the front part of that mouse, you become tamei. But if you touch the earthen part of the second, of the back of the mouse, which has not yet been converted from earth into mouse, you tahor.
That doesn't mean it's been converted from earth to mouse.
You had a mouse which was spontaneously being generated from earth.
Did anybody ever see
that? Well,
I think
the Rambam says that he got many reports about this, even though it sounds strange to him. But it's because it was observed in all of it. Pliny reports it, Aristotle reports it. This is not any fact which was not known to any person who was well-versed in biology at the time. Let's read what the Tefes Israel has to say. Va'ani shamati, I heard, apikorsim malagolim alvriyazu sheneskeret kanu besanhedrin. I heard many apikorsim laughing at this creature, which is mentioned here, and in the Sefer Sanhedrin, umakchishim va'omrim she'ena b'mitziyut klal. And they claim that there is no such thing as a mouse which is spontaneously generated out of earth. Lachein va'iti lahazkir kan. Masha matzati katov b'sefer Ashkenazi shechiber chacham echad mufrosam b'chachmei ha'umot. I therefore saw fit to quote here an article of something that I read in a very famous German biologist's book, Ushmo Link. The biologist's name is Link. B'sifro hanikra Urwelt, in his book which was called The Original World, the old. World. Chelek Aleph Amud Shloshmeot Esfim Moshev, on page 327, Shenim Tzabuya Kazot Eretz Mitzrayim, the Mecholus Pavis. This creature is found in Thebes in Egypt. The Nikweta Achbar Hahi Belashon Mitzrayim Dipus Yakulus, Uvelashon Ashkenaz Springmouth. Shechelek Ashechelek Shelofaneha Rosh Vachazer. That the first, the fore part of this creature are well formed and described. And the last portion of this mouse is still made out of clods of earth. Until a few days later. And this will be changed completely into flesh. After finding this in this current biology book, I said, how great are your works, O Lord? So again, he was searching here for a justification in the biological literature that the statement in the Mishnah could not have been completely false. And he found it. Now what did he find? Link is a well-known biologist, and we now have to examine what, in fact, is in Link's book. This particular Tefes Yisrael is cited by many of the subsequent authorities, like, for example, Rav Kasher in his book Torah Shlema points out again that this Mishnah couldn't have been an error because the Tefes Yisrael actually found this in Land Links book.
Did you want to read Link's book?
Hmm?
Did you want to read
Link's book? Who?
Akasha? Yeah.
I doubt that he could read German. I don't think he knew how to read German. But there was a recent article by Professor Lyman who actually took the trouble of looking at Link's book.
Where is this published?
I just got this in the fax yesterday, so... this was published in some volume dedicated to Dr. Lamb on the occasion of his 70th birthday, date 1997. And the title of the article is Rabbi Israel Lifshitz and the Mouth That Is Half Flesh and Half Earth, a note on Torah Umaba in the 19th century. Remember, Dr. Lamb purportedly is the great supporter of something called Torah Umaba, whatever that is.
It is a journal.
Right. Okay. All right, so... Huh? I think it's in Brooklyn, I don't know. Okay. All right. A cursory read, now I'm reading Professor Lyman, and then we have to analyze in our own mind what was going on here. A cursory reading of this passage would lead one to imagine that Lipschitz had chanced upon a specific treatise by a contemporary scholar which proved that the very creature mentioned by the rabbis was alive and well in Egypt in the 19th century. Alas, an examination of the book cited by Lipschitz proves otherwise. Heinrich Friedrich Link was a distinguished German botanist and zoologist who served as director of the Botanical Gardens and professor of pharmaceutics in Berlin. His Die Urwelt und das Altertum erlautet durch der Naturkunde, the primeval world and antiquity elucidated by natural history, appeared in several editions. But the passage cited by Lipschitz appears only in the first edition, Berlin, 1821, volume 1, page 327, precisely on the page indicated by Lipschitz. But, as indicated by this title, the book treats the primeval world and antiquity. Link gathered together the scientific evidence for the rise of civilization, examining such topics as the natural habitats of incipient animal and human life in antiquity. He was particularly interested in the cosmogonies of antiquity and examined the literary records of ancient India, Persia, Phoenicia, and Babylonia, among others, for evidence of their respective cosmogonies. In his discussion of ancient Egyptian cosmology, Link cites a passage from Diodorus Siculus, the 1st century BCE Greek historian. So first of all, Link is quoting a Greek historian writing in the 1st century before the current era. It reads, in English translation, "Now the Egyptians have an account like this. When in the beginning the universe came into being, man first came into existence in Egypt, both because of the favorable climate of the land and because of the nature of the Nile." We have repercussions of this in the current black propaganda. "For this stream, since it produces much life and provides a spontaneous supply of food, easily supports whatever living things have been engendered, for both the root of the reed and the lotus, as well as the Egyptian bean and the corium, as it's corsium as it's called, and many other similar plants, supply the race of men with nourishment all ready for use. As proof that animal life appeared first of all in their land, they would offer the fact that even at the present day, the soil of a Tebad at certain times generates mice in such numbers and in such size as to astonish all who have witnessed the phenomenon. For some of them are fully formed as far as the breast and front feet are concerned, and are able to move, while the rest of the body is unformed, the clod of earth still retaining its natural character." Indeed, yeah. "Indeed, even in our day, during the inundations of Egypt, the generational forms of animal life can clearly be seen taking place in the pools which remain the longest. For wherever the river has begun to recede and the sun has thoroughly dried the surface of the slime, living animals, they say, take shape, some of them fully formed, but some only half so, and still actually united with the very earth." Diodorus's account, now that's the end of the quote from Diodorus, writing in the 1st century B.C. Diodorus's account of spontaneous generation, and more specifically, of a mouse that was part flesh and part earth, was commonplace in Greco-Roman literature. Others who mention this earthy mouse include Ovid, Pomponius, Mela, Pliny the Elder, and Aelian. Thus it came as no surprise that the rabbis discussed the status of a creature they had never seen, and one that modern scholarship would label as imaginary. The greatest scientists and historians of their day took its existence for granted. If so, its halachic status needed to be discussed and clarified. But this was not Lipschitz's response to the 19th century Jewish heretics, nor was it his understanding of the Diodorus passage cited by Rink. Note that Lipschitz informs us that the mouse is called in Egyptian Dipus Yaculus and in German Springmaus. None of this appears or could even appear in Diodorus, who wrote in Greek, not in Latin, nor would Diodorus imagine that Dipus Yaculus was Egyptian. What happened is that Link added a footnote to the Diodorus passage in an attempt to account for the belief in the existence of this strange creature in antiquity. Link's note reads, in translation, the Springmaus, Dipus Yaculus, which dwells in Upper Egypt and is characterized by very short forelegs, doubtless could lead one to conclude that it is not a yet fully formed creature. So what happened here is Link wrote in a footnote an explanation of why there was a false belief in antiquity of a mouse being half formed, because there is a creature that looks something like a tiny little kangaroo with short forelegs and long rear legs that people could confuse with the idea that the front part is fully formed and the back part isn't yet fully formed. Okay. Now, the Tefas Yisrael instead misquotes this statement by Link to give the impression that the most recent up-to-date scientific knowledge by the great German botanist and biologist and historian of science and so on testifies to the existence of this creature, and the Tefas Yisrael was then copied by all the later scholars, including Rav Kasher and so on. Now, I don't believe for a minute that there was a deliberate fraud here. I think that what happened was that there was some deep emotional reaction against the idea that the Mishnah could be talking about a creature that never existed, because current scientific knowledge says that spontaneous generation of such things as mice can't happen. He was looking for some kind of a thing. He saw this quote of the first century historian, Diodorus, and maybe his eye skimmed over a footnote and didn't read carefully, and therefore didn't want to push this matter any further, because psychologically it would have offended him to find out that in fact this is all imaginary, and then reported it and believed that he had read this in this book, and then reported it such in the All right. In the 1800s, it was still up in the air as to whether bacteria and such could be spontaneously generated. They had narrowed it down to that. Nobody at that stage had already believed that mice could be spontaneously generated. And it's true that only in the 1860s was this true, that there's no such thing as spontaneous generation. And remember that spontaneous generation worked the absence of spontaneous generation worked against the atheists, because the fact that life was somehow different from all other things and could only be produced from prior life, at least at that time when vitalism still existed, doesn't exist today, but was something contrary to people who are against religion. All right. Now, we've mentioned many other things. Let me also, in the same article, Professor Lyman quotes a letter from Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch to Rabbi someone by the name of Wexler, written in 1876. And again, a perfectly straightforward letter in the spirit of what we would like to hope for. Anyone who engages in the study of the words of the sages must above all realize that they were primarily scholars of the divine law, transmitting and teaching the Torah and its precepts. They were not, as such, biologists, mathematicians, astronomers, or physicians, except insofar as knowledge in these fields was relevant and required for the proper understanding and observance of the Torah and mitzvot. Knowledge of these disciplines was not part of the Sinaitic tradition. Even in one's own field of study, it is neither possible nor expected to discover and know everything by means of one's own observation, one's own experiments. Most of one's knowledge is dependent upon researches done by others. Shadil's proof to have been erroneous, no blame is attached to the individual. It is sufficient merit to have acquired all the established body of knowledge in one's field. In no way is one's stature diminished if, during a later age, it is discovered that some of the propositions relied on were flawed. Such, too, is the case with respect to the sages' knowledge in the sciences. They required the body of scientific knowledge as established. They acquired the body of scientific knowledge as established in their age. In this respect, their scholarship was on a par with that of their Gentile contemporaries. Imagine, for instance, a man like Humboldt living in their age. He would set out on his journeys of explorations and report from a distant land that there existed creatures with a human shape growing from the ground, or that there existed mice produced from the soil, and that mice, half earth, half animal, and similar creatures were still extant, and the existence of such creatures was widely held to be true and factual. Would we not expect the sages to discuss the status of these creatures from a Torah viewpoint and clarify their status with respect to the forbidden and the permitted, cleanliness and uncleanliness, even without their setting out to verify the existence of such creatures? Because we know today that thus creatures were but fantasy, can we hold the sages responsible for tales accepted as factual by all men of science in their age? These tales are in fact found in the works of Pliny the Elder, who lived in Rome, etc. Perfect. Right, half human. I believe that whenever we find a startling statement of this nature made by the sages and we research it properly, we will find that it was a widely held belief in those days. And so on. So this is a perfectly reasonable position taken by Rabbi Hirsch. And of course, Rabbi Hirsch's position may have lasted a generation or two, but it's certainly not the one that's maintained by the current young men of the Breuer community, because they've again all been completely absorbed by the anti-science right-wing viewpoint. And let's, for example, see what...
One minor point. I think that the Parish of Souls writes about that the age of the Earth is not necessarily what we'd assume. It wasn't like he was so totally anti...
I never said that.
I'm just bringing up that issue.
Yeah, right. It was just, for the Catharsis as well, it was psychologically difficult for him to accept that the rabbis could be in error on crucial issues, but he did accept it, as you say, on some things, and this was he would be very happy to have found a answer which would indicate that perhaps the rabbis weren't all that wrong. On the other hand, for someone like Rabbi Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, it was taken for granted that the position that I've maintained, much to, despite various bitter attacks on my position, namely that the rabbis dealt with the sciences as they understood them at that time and on the basis of their relevant knowledge. This is not acceptable today. For example, even someone like Rav Kook would not be able to tolerate this position. Let's take a look on my page 20, because I'm running close to my tune-out time. There are three tshuvot from Rav Kook that I quote here. I'll read this one, which was the first one, which was written when he was a young man, but this one was written in, 1921, so he was at the height of his powers. Al-Drar she'elot ha-matzitza. V'hineh, he writes, Bein mitmagdei ha-matzitza yeshnon arba kitot. Kat achat ha-omeret levatel legamri et ha-matzitza, v'heim ba'in v'ta'anot mitzad chachmat ha-rufua, she'omrim ha-rufim she'bzman lezeh meniyat ha-matzitza ein bah sakana, ulehefach ha-matzitza tuchal havi lidei tzakana alma yidei machalot ha-nitakot yotzuk yotzei bah. Okay? So he lists four different opinions, the first of which says that the current medical opinion says that not only is matzitza unnecessary, but dangerous, because by then the germ theory of disease was in existence. Let's skip to the next paragraph. V'hine im ha-chafetzim le'ekor et kol ha-matzitza kula, ein lanu ma ledaber kla. We won't even talk to people who want to eliminate matzitza entirely. V'ein lanu lazuz midivrei chachameinu zal. We cannot deviate from the opinion of our sages, where our sages say that this is any surgeon who refuses to perform the tzitza should be dismissed. Even if our doctors today say that nature has changed, etc., there's no merit whatsoever in these opponents. Chada, shemakom makom sha'anu omim nishtanu atva'im, any places in which we say that nature has changed, tzrichim al zehu chacha brura v'nisayon nuhura. We need complete proof and absolute experiment. V'kan ein lehem bazeh shum biru. They have no proof whatsoever to their position. V'lo od el shekol ikar nehemanut harofim, all times in which we rely on doctors' opinions, enu ki im ipnei hasafek. It's only when we ourselves have a doubt. V'samchim aleihem l'hakel b'chilul Shabbat u'b'ta'anit yom ha'kipurim. We rely on doctors in cases where we have doubt to violate the Sabbath or allow eating on Yom Kippur. U'v'shar inyanei yisur m'pnei hasakana mishum safek nefashelt l'hakel. But on matters of dinim deoraita, we certainly don't accept medical knowledge as certain. In Cain, kevan shechazal amru shebelo metzitza havi sakanta, since the rabbis have said that without metzitza it's dangerous, surichim davka ledaat yediyah brua she'ein shum sakana. We need definite proof that there is no sakana, but al zeh ein lahem shum na'amanut. And on this matter, doctors have absolutely no reliability. V'imkein afilu imhem bodi'im midatam chshash sakana, even if they have some imaginary danger, like infection, ein omrim. We say that the doctor's doubts cannot take us away from the certainty of our sages. And the doctor's worries about infection and all other kinds of things are only imaginary things because it goes contrary to what's explicitly stated in the Talmud. So even someone whom we all admire, like Rabbi Cook, was unable to take the simple stated position, which is that rabbis may not have had the up-to-date medical opinion. So something that Rav Hirsch could write 50 years before, Rabbi Cook could not tolerate when he was the chief rabbi of the Holy Land. Now, my time is just about up. I should tell you that on this very issue, that is the question of scientific knowledge contradicting the statements of the rabbis, we have some really here. Here's a newspaper headline. Hamishtara atzra shisha pe'ilei meretz shechilku ilonei kfira b'bnei Brak. The police have arrested 6 activists of the Meretz Party who distributed heretical tracts in Bnei Brak. So you can, according to that newspaper, no one has to believe the newspaper, right? You can get arrested in Israel today for circulating this document that says that in fact that the rabbis were not infallible on scientific matters.
Well, why were they
provocation?
The provocation. Blasphemy. These people have nothing to do with merits. What has happened is that this issue of whether, first of all, like papal infallibility that took place when belief in tradition, Christian religion, remember the doctrine of papal infallibility only became an official doctrine in the late 19th century. Papal infallibility means that the Catholics have to believe that the Pope can never make a mistake.
On doctrinal
matters. You now have a universal opinion shared by all of the religious parties that the rabbis could not make a mistake on scientific matters. This has now, of course, become part of politics. it's not just simply a matter of religious doctrine, it's a matter of politics, and you can get arrested for making this kind of an outrageous claim according to the religious newspapers. I don't have to believe that these people were actually arrested, but you can very well imagine that if the religious parties achieve a victory in the next election, then you would be arrested for daring to claim that the rabbis were fallible when it comes to scientific doctrine.
The theology is not there.
No, but
I don't make sense.
Right. We are entering into a very weird, strange, and difficult time, and it's hard for me to imagine what the outgrowth is. Next week there will be some demonstration, of course, as you know, in Jerusalem, against the rule of democratic law, against the Supreme Court and the legal system in Israel, because they're ruling the country not according to the halacha. But of course, ruling the country according to the halacha will mean, according to these same people on the doctrine of Das Torah and papal infallibility, that science was has no value when it contradicts the rabbinical statements. I remember about 15 or 20 years ago, there was an election in Israel when one of the candidates, I think of the Likud party, was running against the second law of thermodynamics. He was proposing some particular economic project which was clearly impossible based on the second law of thermodynamics, and I thought that was an amusing account of the democratic procedures where a basic tenet of science could be put to the vote. When I discussed my outrage at this work of Steinberg to Rav Amital, who was the head of the yeshiva in Gush Etzion, that how could anyone be so stupid as to make claims as to the infallibility of rabbis on scientific matters and claim that nature has changed, he said to me, I thought he was being sarcastic, he said to me, well, at least they recognize that nature has changed. Unfortunately, I didn't take him seriously at the time. I thought that he was just being a little... just being very sad because he realizes that he has no effect whatsoever on the students that come through his yeshiva. He says that they come in with a tekela on their back and he can't change their minds about anything. And so I thought that he was just expressing his own despair. But unfortunately, he's proved to be correct, that one is entering into a stage of know-nothingism of a peculiar kind, which is not the remember, if your livelihood and your whole lifestyle depends upon your party being elected, remember you have your population of 300,000 people, 60% of the heads of the household are yeshiva, full-time yeshiva students, so they're all being supported by the state. If your whole lifestyle and livelihood depends on this, then the issue of whether or not the trachea branches out into the aortas, or whether or not there is such a thing as spontaneous generation, is a minor point in comparison to the issue of whether you'll be able, and your family will be able to eat next year. So one has entered into a very strange mix of politics and religion, in which the most extreme positions are now the standard political party platforms. Okay, let's talk a little bit about scheduling. I hope in Yitzhak Hashem we'll have a shiur next week.